From WPR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The Academy Awards will take place Sunday night at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. Alfonso Cuarón's Roma enters the evening with 10 nominations, including for Best Picture. You've been listening to Te Prometido, the first song on that film's soundtrack. Roma, a story of Mexico City and social and political upheaval in 1970, is joined by seven other films about such topics as a black police officer's efforts against the Klan, a vice president's unlikely backstory, the intrigue surrounding an impulsive British queen, an unexpected rock star, a black superhero, a remake of an archetypical Hollywood tale about fame. For more than 90 years, Oscar night has defined cinematic achievement. It is an occasion marinated in the manufacture of tradition, but it risks running aground. No host to make viewers laugh and to puncture the self-importance. No guarantee a traditional studio will take home the big awards, as Netflix's Roma is the talk of Tinseltown. For the next hour, we'll talk about the year's best movies and performances and the forces that got them to the screen. This hour on Point, everything you need to know about Hollywood's biggest night. And later this hour, Jussie Smollett and the credibility of hate crime victims. First, the Oscars. Which of this year's top films or performances captured you, and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me right here in New York City is A.O. Scott. He is chief film critic for the New York Times. Tony, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
And from Kansas City, Missouri, Sean Edwards joins us, film critic for Fox 4 News there in Kansas City, co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Sean, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So let's get to it briefly, and let's talk first about the show itself. There's been a lot of controversy. I want to get to the films for the core of this show, but for a couple of minutes. Sean, tell us a little bit about the controversies about the show and whether viewers are even going to care.
Well, I mean, viewers always care because people love movies. But the show itself and the people who are producing the show, it's been a mess since this summer. They've had one misstep after another. I mean, it first started earlier in the summer back in 2018 with the announcement of a best popular movie category, which was completely ridiculous and had no business even being thought up in the first place. And then recently there have been announcements like they weren't going to award all of the categories during the telecast, which was another huge mistake and just a disservice to all the people that work on the films and all the people that were nominated. I mean, you have to show all the categories during the show. I don't care how long the show runs. You have to do that. Then there was another announcement that only two of the five people that were nominated for Best Song would actually perform during the show and not all five, which was another huge mistake. And then the fact that you had the controversy over the host. So there have been so many problems with the way this show has been produced and some of the things they've done to tinker with trying to either, you know, retain the audience they have or increase the audience that they want without even understanding that the way that people watch television has completely changed from the way it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. You're not going to have those huge numbers. There aren't groups of people. There aren't families sitting around one television in one room in one house anymore. There are different ways that we want our content. There are different ways that we watch TV now. So you're never going to have those huge numbers. So they're basically like a dog chasing its tail. I mean, just produce a great show. Talk about the great cinematic achievements that have been rewarded and give the nominees their full due respect during the telecast.
Tony Scott, it seems to me almost every year, every other year, there's some criticism of the way in which the Academy handles the Oscars, right? What does this controversy tell us about, I don't know, the state of Hollywood's and the movies? What does it tell us about ourselves?
Well, I mean, I think Sean is right. It tells us something about the state of television, first of all, because, I mean, ABC has invested an enormous amount of money and gives an enormous amount of money, pays the Academy huge sums of money for the broadcast rights to the show, and I believe they're paid in through 2028.
Wow.
And you know, so they want to show that as many people in the world will sit down and watch. But the thing is that the whole ecology of popular culture and media has really changed. So, as Sean said, it's true that people don't sit around and watch a real-time network broadcast in the same way that they used to. You know, back even 15 or 20 years ago, the highest-rated Oscars I think were 1998 when Titanic won and Billy Crystal was host, and 57 million people watched. Last year's I think were the lowest-rated with Jimmy Kimmel hosting, and I can't even remember what one, The Shape of Water. But so the movie audience is also kind of fragmenting in a way. There are big blockbuster movies like Black Panther and the Star Wars and Marvel franchises, which go out all over the world and are seen all over the world. But there are also a lot of interesting, ambitious, smaller movies that reach smaller audiences that the Academy has also been rewarding. And there's a tension there because there's often a worry that if the movies aren't popular enough, if not enough of the big blockbuster movies get paraded out there on Oscar night, then the audiences are going to go away. But I think it's just the sort of the state we're in. There are a lot of interesting movies. There are a lot of different kinds of movies. There are a lot of different ways to watch movies.
So let me illustrate the tension that you're talking about. Let's start with two clips of two of the movies under consideration for Best Film. Black Panther. Here's a pivotal scene from the Marvel, I guess franchise starter, perhaps. The young king of the fictional African nation Wakanda is T'Challa. He's played by Chadwick Boseman. T'Challa's cousin, played by Michael B. Jordan, is arguing with him in this scene over who gets to lead the nation.
Y'all sitting up here comfortable. Must feel good. It's about 2 billion people all over the world that looks like us. But their lives are a lot harder. Wakanda has the tools to liberate them all.
And what tools are those?
Vibranium. Your weapons.
Our weapons will not be used to wage war on the world. It is not our way to be judge, jury, and executioner for people who are not our own.
Not your own. But didn't life start right here on this continent? So ain't all people your people?
I am not king of all people. I am king of Wakanda.
A blockbuster movie made about $74 gazillion there, about Wakanda, and now a scene about a movie about a very different monarch, The Favorite, about the British monarch Queen Anne, a much smaller film. In this film, Anne is played by Olivia Colman. The queen is imperious, anxious, self-doubting, and enthralled to her companion and confidant, Sarah Churchill, portrayed by Rachel Weisz. Churchill gives her the queen counsel on matters both public and private. The first voice you hear belongs to the queen.
I'm ready for the Russian ambassador.
Who did your makeup?
We went for something dramatic. Do you like it?
You look like a badger.
Oh.
Are you going to cry? Really?
Well, what do you think you look like? Badger. Do you really think you can meet the Russian delegation looking like that?
Nope.
I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Thank you.
Tony Scott, I got to tell you, this just makes me laugh. So how do you evaluate two films of such, both involving monarchs apparently, but of such widely different senses of tone and scope, yes, against one another?
Uneasy is the head that wears the crown.
Or the badger.
I mean, I think that to me the coexistence of these two movies in theaters and in the Academy's field of nominees is a wonderful thing. It testifies to the diversity of movies, of the different kinds of movies that are out there, and not every movie is to every taste or for every audience, but I do think that there's a lot of craft and ingenuity and talent involved in both of these movies. I mean, I think they're two of the best production designed and costume designed movies of the year, and they kind of showcase all of the different aspects of film creativity that the Academy is really dedicated to celebrating, and that the Oscars are supposed to be all about.
Sean Edwards, tell me what film grabbed you.
Well, the film that grabbed me the most in 2018 was Black Panther, because it was such a cultural phenomena. I mean, on the surface, yes, it is a comic book movie. It's produced by Marvel, and we've seen 18 other Marvel movies before, but there was something different about this movie that moved a certain demographic in a way that I've never seen a movie do so. I mean, this is one of those moments in cinematic history that a lot of people will be talking about for the rest of their lives. And it was just the way that Black Panther as a whole sort of washed away that total negative stigma that the continent of Africa had been facing in the totality of cinematic history. It gave a lot of people a sense of pride. It made a lot of people feel good. It was a character doing things that people had never seen before. And it had people doing things that I never imagined people would do. It had African Americans dressing up to actually attend a movie. I'd never seen that before, at least not in mass. I mean, you had kids all over dressing up like their favorite characters for Halloween. You literally had people crying, and I knew this movie was a big deal when my mom wanted to go see that. She doesn't know the difference between Black Panther, Superman, and Wonder Woman. She had never seen a comic book movie in her life, and she loved the movie, and she was in tears and wanted to see it again.
Sean, I mean, I'm the amateur in this discussion, but it seemed to me like it was just a really well-made movie in addition.
Well, that's
and so the combination of the phenomenon and the movie making, and it you talk about a certain demographic and the pride and you know appeal that African Americans took in this, but it also seemed to me to speak to folks beyond that community.
No,
right?
It's a mainstream hit. A movie's not going to make $1.3 billion and not appeal universally. And right. that was the beautiful thing about this movie is that it had universal appeal, but for that core demo, it did so many things that I've never seen a movie do. The closest thing in my lifetime that I've ever seen would be like when Roots, the miniseries, hit television back in the late 70s, but this was
right.
a film. This is a different thing. This is a different ballgame. I've never really seen a movie move and sort of energize people the way Black Panther did.
And we're going to pick all that up. You're hearing from the film critics Sean Edwards and Tony Scott. We're discussing the Oscars and the biggest films and performances of the past year. We're going out with all the stars performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA from Black Panther, the album released last year. This one's up for Best Original Song. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Maybe all those things that you love so are waiting in the place where the lost things go. Memories you've shared.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. That was a bit of The Place Where the Lost Things Go, sung by Emily Blunt, who plays Mary Poppins in the film Mary Poppins Returns. It's nominated for Best Original Song. You can join our conversation. We're talking about the Oscars, which airs this Sunday. Which performances stand out to you? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. The magic of Hollywood, Anna Wintour's assistant in The Devil Wears Prada, becomes the singing Mary Poppins. With me today, Tony Scott, chief film critic for The New York Times, and Sean Edwards, noted film critic for Fox 4 News in Kansas City. I want to take a couple of calls now about your inclinations, what appealed to you. First, I'd like to go to Lexington, Kentucky. Ashley, go right ahead.
Yeah, so I actually really appreciated how Roma showed this beautiful yet kind of mundane depiction of everyday life of a family in a different culture. And how really, in retrospect, it really wasn't that different from my own quote-unquote American life. And I feel like that was for this time of...
Okay, I'm losing you a little bit, Ashley. One vote for Roma. Thank you for your call. I want to take a call from Newton, Massachusetts as well. Karen, go right ahead.
Hi, another vote for Roma. I was going to say is in this anxious age of Trump, I'm more likely to want to see Mary Poppins. Uh-huh. And Roma was about another nanny, and it was a a love letter to an indigenous woman, probably the first time a person of her class has been portrayed in that way as being the protagonist of the movie. And I'm very glad that I took Ty Burr's advice. He's our local Boston film critic, to see it in the movies, because you couldn't really appreciate the cinematography and the scope of this drama on the television, I don't think, unless you have an enormous TV and could darken the room. But on the big screen, the cinematography was so powerful. The story was so powerful. And it was, it really touched the heart and the soul.
Thank you for that, Karen. I got to say, I saw the movie at home on my TV during the daytime, and I was absolutely emotionally moved by it. It was just an extraordinary film. I think we have a clip of it right here.
¿Y ahora tú qué tienes? ¿Qué? ¿No me vas a hablar?
No puedo. Estoy muerto.
Entonces resucita, pues, y ya nos vamos.
No puedo. Estoy muerto.
So that's a scene between a maid who works for a middle-class family in Mexico City. The year is 1970. The maid Cleo is incredibly involved and invested in the lives of the young children of the family. She's portrayed by nominee Yalitza Aparicio, who's not only just a first-time nominee but a first-time actor. Tony Scott, what did you make of Roma?
I think Roma is a lovely movie for the reasons that that the caller Karen very I think eloquently stated. It takes you into the life of this family and to this character Cleo in a very sensitive and empathetic and wise way. I mean, I think the little boy, the scene up there on the roof. You have to kind of believe that little boy, who's one of the younger of the four children in this family, might be a stand-in for Alfonso Cuarón, the director, mm-hmm. Who based it on his own life and on the woman who worked for his family in this Roma neighborhood in Mexico City in the 1970s. So it's I think part of the reason that it works so well as a film about its place and time and its characters is because it's a very personal film. You can really feel not only Cuarón's amazing artistry as a cinematographer, as a writer, as a director of actors, as an imagination, but also his own personal and emotional investment in the story, which gives it its warmth, I think.
You've seen, it seems to me, in recent years, some criticism of the genre of relationships between domestic workers and families that work with them. She clearly is, as you say, emotionally bound up in there. And yet you do see issues of race and class very much explored there. I believe that Cleo is Oaxacan, an indigenous. Yeah. You see, even in this black and white film, very, I think, tangibly evoked the distinctions between those who clearly delineate themselves as sort of Spanish Mexicans mm-hmm. and those who are indigenous peoples there. You know, it makes these strong points clearly but subtly, I think.
Yeah, and it doesn't, I think, sugarcoat or sentimentalize the relationships of servants and their employers. And I think it's very, in a way, candid and also very nuanced about the politics within the family and also the politics of race and class within the nation that are involved which haven't gone away. There's been some backlash against this movie in Mexico, and in particular against Yalitza Aparicio's nomination for this Oscar. She's not really an actor. She's an amateur. She's just the most telling criticism has been she's just playing herself, which is just kind of, I think, racist on its face in a way that an indigenous person, of course, is playing a servant because that's what she essentially would have to be. And I think that's exposed the persistence of those attitudes and those divisions within Mexico today, just as we still, have them here.
Now, Sean Edwards, a lot of the industry has gone gaga for Roma, and at the same time, there are those who don't like it. You are on record. You felt it didn't really speak to you. Tell me about your reaction to the film as a viewer and as a critic.
Well, I mean, you know, first, I can combine the two as a viewer and a critic. I mean, Alfonso Cuarón is a brilliant filmmaker, and from a filmmaking standpoint, Roma is flawless. I just found it incredibly boring, and it didn't move me the way it's moved other people. I just thought it was dull. I didn't get it. I didn't buy into it. There wasn't one memorable scene that stuck with me. I've seen the movie three times, so I went back to see if I was missing something, and then went back again. And all three of the times that I've screened the movie have been in a movie theater. I just don't feel it the way other people do. I just thought it was flat. I mean, Cuarón's movies tend to be dull. I mean, Gravity was a technical marvel, but the story was completely flat. And I sort of feel the same with Roma. It just didn't move the needle for me the way it does other people.
Gravity was slow. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I find his movies very very absorbing and exciting. And I mean, Gravity in a way for me was the thinnest. I felt that, you know, Roma, it took a while. And I think one thing about the fact that a lot of people are watching it on their TV streaming through Netflix, which is something maybe we should talk about. Roma is unprecedented in a couple of ways. If it wins, it would be the first foreign language film to win Best Picture. And it's also the first Netflix movie to be in serious contention for Oscars, which is in a way a potential earthquake in Hollywood. But I would say that
not, you're saying, by which you mean, hey, this isn't playing down at my old movie theater was bought out by six different chains in downtown, but nonetheless, bought out by some chain. This is something you're seeing on your screens, basically.
It's about the model.
Because it's not only that. It's that this would be the first Best Picture winner, if it were to win, about which no box office information is known. That is, it's always been one of the measurements in Hollywood of success is how many people went and bought tickets. Netflix does not release its streaming numbers and has not released its box office numbers either. So in a way, there's this big question mark about what the public has been for this movie, what the audience is. It exists as something that's available on this subscription service that was put into theaters partly as a way to get awards recognition and a publicity bump and a lot of reviews. But no movie that has gone this far in any awards race has ever been released in this way.
So let's talk about a different distinction between the Academy and the public. Among the people recognized as among the most innovative and original voices as directors go is Spike Lee. And Spike Lee's films have not won Best Picture, although people have thought that they should have qualified a number of times. If you think of Black Klansman, released last year, a dramatization of real live events, it follows the story of Ron Stallworth, the first African-American detective to serve in the Colorado Springs, Colorado Police Department. Stallworth is played by John David Washington. That last name should be familiar, Denzel's son. Stallworth plans to go undercover to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan, but in so doing, makes a critical error.
Listen, when can you meet?
How about Friday night after I get off work?
That's a deal, buddy boy. We'll get right back to you with the details. Take care now.
God bless white America.
Did I just hear you use your real name?
That last voice belonging to another police officer played by Adam Driver. Sean Edwards, talk to me about Black Klansman. Is it one of Lee's better films?
It is one of his top-tier films, but before I start on that, I just think it's criminal that Spike had never been nominated for Best Director until this year. That's just, he's not only one of the most influential black filmmakers of our generation, he's one of the most influential filmmakers of our generation, period. And for him to have never been nominated almost made me sick to my stomach. So congratulations for finally getting the nomination. And I definitely believe he deserves the win this year. But no, this is one of his better films. And it's out of the eight movies nominated for Best Picture, this is the one film that is directed by Spike Lee, and only Spike Lee could have directed this movie. The other seven movies could have possibly been directed by other directors, but not Black Klansman.
Tony Scott, I see you nodding your head.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, going all the way back to She's Gotta Have It and Do the Right Thing, it'd be hard to think of a director, an American director, with a more interesting and provocative and accomplished slate of films, fictional, documentary, all different genres. Who has been, you know, he got the a Lifetime Achievement, you know, honorary Oscar, but he's never gotten the real statue. So he's overdue. But that apart, this movie, I think Sean is absolutely right. I think it's one of his best, and I think only he could have taken this material and done it in a way that this movie is funny. It's surprising, it's suspenseful, it's shocking, it's horrifying. It ends with just a kind of devastating punch to the gut. It kind of does all of these things with the tone and the story and the characters and the subject matter that no other filmmaker could pull that off in that way. And I think you know, I would love to see it. I would love to see Spike Lee on that stage with a statue in his hand, giving the world a piece of his mind.
That would be incredible.
Go ahead. Yeah,
even the flaws in this movie, because Spike Lee has certain flaws when he directs, even the flaws are well executed and enjoyable. That's what makes him such a great director, is that sometimes he can make your skin crawl and make your eyes roll, and you're still like, well, that's Spike Lee, so it's cool.
Does it matter, Sean Edwards, that people say, look, this film was sold with a little bit of sleight of hand? It's not as though the black police officer is going undercover. Does it matter that it seems, as some African-American critics have said, you know, there's been some real license taken with the factual material, that is, that it appears as though Ron Stallworth may have been involved much more in infiltrating certain kinds of black power groups than he was in infiltrating the Klan?
Yeah, but that's not the story that's being told with this film. I don't really like going down that road where we start like over fact checking movies that are clearly not documentaries. Like, if it's a documentary, that's one thing, but this is a work of fiction, and it's done so that cinematic experience can be enjoyed from a certain perspective that Spike delivers as the director of the movie. So no, I don't have any qualms with the way it was delivered. And I love the way it was set up, and I love the way that it was executed. And it's not a documentary. It's a work of fiction that's based on real life events, but not, it doesn't say that this is a blow by blow actual true story. It's based on the events. So you have some cinematic liberties and licensing you can take.
Tony Scott, there are certain performances that you really liked a lot that weren't in a film that was going to be under consideration for Best Picture. And you particularly liked the film, the two performances leading Can You Ever Forgive Me? What spoke to you about those?
Well, this is a movie about New York in the early 90s. It's based on a true story about a writer played by Melissa McCarthy, who's kind of her career has hit the skids. And so she starts forging letters by different literary and Hollywood celebrities. And Melissa, this is a very well-written, very well-directed, very smart movie that, I mean, it's a kind of a small-scale story. It's a character study. It's very true to its place and its moment. But Melissa McCarthy is so good in it, doing not you know, showing what a terrific actress she is.
Rather than broad comedy.
Yeah. I mean, she's very funny, but it's also a very kind of very sad and very honest performance. And she's her sidekick in this movie is the amazing Richard E. Grant. And the two of them, as these kind of improbable, you know, pair of con artists in you know, terrorizing the bookstores of the Upper West Side and other parts of Manhattan, are just, for me, such a pleasure to watch them. I would love to see either one or both of them get recognized.
I'm seeing one Twitter listener saying, totally pulling for Richard E. Grant, a great performance from the guy who anchored the iconic With Nail and I. Let me briefly ask you, Sean Edwards, in 20 seconds, is there a performance not recognized in one of the Best Picture nominees that you particularly want to highlight?
Yeah, I do. I want to highlight Amanda Stenberg, who is the lead in The Hate U Give, which I thought was an incredible movie and a fantastic performance, because she carried that entire movie and did things that none of the five women nominated for Best Actress did. I mean, it was just, it's one of the most overlooked performances in a long time.
We're counting down to the Oscars. We're here with in studio. I have Tony Scott. We also have Sean Edwards in studio over in Kansas City. We're glad to have them both. Want to have your conversation. What made you care about this year's crop of films? To close out this segment, I'm leaving you with I'll Fight from the documentary RBG. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Grammy winner, Jennifer Hudson, performs this track, nominated for Best Original Song at the Oscars. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point. When each night is like a battle you can't win, and the pain is like a weight you're carrying, I will be the one to help you carry it. I will take all your troubles. Oh, I know it's the fight. So I'll fight. Fight that war for you.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. This is On Point. That is not my voice, but that of Lady Gaga singing Shallow, nominated for Best Song, and is from the movie A Star Is Born. We're talking about the Academy Awards, past, present, and future. You can join our conversation. What burning questions do you have for our critics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here with us today, Sean Edwards, the noted film critic for Fox 4 News Kansas City, and Tony Scott, the chief film critic at the New York Times. I want to play for you cuts of a couple of the other movies up for contention for Best Picture. First, the film Vice, when George W. Bush, as portrayed by Sam Rockwell, offered Dick Cheney the chance to be his running mate, he seemed to hit an impasse. Cheney, as played by Christian Bale under a lot of padding, was seeking a lot more power than most vice presidents.
I want you to be my VP. You're the solution to my problem.
I'm CEO of a large company. I have been Secretary of Defense. I have been the Chief of Staff. The vice presidency is mostly a symbolic job.
Right, right. I can see how that wouldn't be enticing to you.
However.
And in that however, history was made. Turn then to Green Book. Another movie based on a true story, this one set in 1962. Viggo Mortensen plays a white nightclub bouncer named Tony Lip, who's hired to drive a black concert pianist named Don Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, on tour in the South. In this scene, Tony Lip introduces Don Shirley to fried chicken.
It just seems so unsanitary.
Just relax and enjoy it. You know, my father used to say, whatever you do, do it 100%. When you work, work. When you laugh, laugh. When you eat, eat like it's your last meal. You want another piece? Here, have a breast. Delicious.
Sean Edwards, seems to me as a viewer that the folks making Green Book knew they were playing with an incredibly incendiary stereotype and trying to send it up. Did it work for you?
It was okay. It was cute. It's a total Oscar bait movie. I mean, it was a fairly interesting story, but the way that the movie was executed was like completely conventional and almost something that could have been made for television for me.
It seemed as though in some ways it was like a reverse Driving Miss Daisy, according to a lot of folks. And I got to say, you know, watching some of it, it felt as though it was trying to make us feel good about ourselves a little bit on both sides, right?
Well, it did pull that off. I mean, it totally, that's what it's most effective at doing. It's not a bad movie. It's not a great movie. And I did enjoy watching it. I just don't think it's an Oscar-worthy type movie.
Tony Scott, you wrote a bit about your discomfort with that.
I mean, I felt like it was, you know, a very sort of sentimental and comforting and soothing look at racism and at the Jim Crow South and a kind of a Hollywood approach to that sort of material that suggests that, well, the problem's solved. And if we could just, you know, all just be friends and I guess, you know, sit down and eat fried chicken together, you know, all of the problems that have plagued this country for years would go away. I mean, it's interesting to think that it and, that Green Book and Black Klansman are nominated in the same year.
You gotta say, right?
That's very strange, right?
It's very strange. And I think that the thing that would set off the hot takes that would break the internet would be if Green Book were to win Best Picture and Spike Lee were to win Best Director. I just think that you know, we would have a very interesting conversation on Monday morning.
Well, Green Book to me, it's what I call like a cough drop movie. Like when you're totally ill and you have the flu and you try to take a cough drop to soothe the pain. That's exactly what this movie is. It's a cough drop movie.
Yeah, and I think Black Klansman is a sort of rip off the Band-Aid movie where it's not, you know,
right. Stitches for that
yes,
matter.
Yeah,
you know, Tony Scott, your colleague Brooke Barnes, not so many days ago, had a piece about who might win Best Picture and talked to 20 Oscar insiders about this. One of the things that this story did, and it's not the first time, but it did it rather pungently, I thought, was talked about the extent to which a lot of these votes are political votes. A lot of these votes are, I want to affirm an emotion. A lot of these votes are, people acknowledge they hadn't seen the films they wanted to vote for. People said, well, I can't vote for Roma because of Netflix. I don't want to do something for Black Panther because it's Disney. Like, this seemed to me like as cynical as we all think things are, this seemed to me to say, yeah, no, it's that cynical.
Well, I mean, it's Hollywood, Jake. but it's a reminder that the Academy is not a group of movie fans or even movie critics. It's an industry
Amen.
Body. And it's people who have an investment in the industry and in an idea of what they want to represent and what they want to show about the industry. And also have friends and enemies involved in all of the films that are under consideration. And so are voting based on their personal connections, based on their biases, on their prejudices, and notoriously don't always watch all of the movies, or even the entire movie that they you know put in,
even among the finalists,
and this is something you know to that I think you know Sean and I and people in our profession we take offense at this because it's you know our job is to watch the whole movie and to only judge movies that we've actually seen and. You know, when it turns out that the high-ranking professionals in the industry aren't doing even that much due diligence, yes, it is perhaps cause for a little cynicism.
All right, we gotta wrap up, Sean Edwards. I want to give you almost a yes no for the last question. Is Vice okay. on there because the Academy wants to take a slap at the Bush years and the Republican Party, or is it not going to win because they felt that the movie was sour and they didn't like it?
It's not going to win because it was too SNL like.
Uh huh.
It felt like a 2-hour SNL skit.
Well, I got to say, the sharpest thing about it struck me was the one point that was most like an SNL skit, but there may be a reason for that. You've been listening to Sean Edwards, film critic and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you very much.
And Tony Scott, chief film critic of the New York Times. Pleasure to have you back.
My pleasure, as always.
We're going to go out with a little ditty here. You might recognize him by ditty. I mean rock anthem. It's the Oscar-nominated Best Picture, Bohemian Rhapsody, featuring previously unreleased audio recordings from Queen's Live Aid performance in 1985. In a moment, we'll take a look at the scandal that has engulfed Jussie Smollett, a star of the hit TV show Empire. This is On Point. Yesterday morning, Chicago Police Chief Eddie Johnson revealed the conclusion to a case that has commanded national headlines.
Jussie Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism to promote his career. I'm left hanging my head and asking why. Why would anyone, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations?
The TV star faces a felony charge for falsely claiming that two men had attacked him last month near his Chicago apartment in a hate crime targeting his race and sexual orientation. Smollett stands accused of paying two brothers to carry out the seemingly vicious assault to raise his profile. Through his attorney, Smollett continues to deny having played a role in his attack. Fox has dropped the actor from the final two episodes of Empire. Joining me from New York City is Clay Kane, host of SiriusXM's The Clay Kane Show. His piece for The Washington Post yesterday had the headline, "Jussie Smollett isn't the reason black LGBT hate crime victims aren't believed." Clay, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, when you've written about the intersectionality of your identity and that of others, which is to say of being both African-American and gay. When you first heard about this attack, what did it inspire in you?
Well, naturally, I had compassion. You know, I had compassion. I had empathy because I know so many people who have been assaulted, who have been killed, and nobody spoke their names, and there were no hashtags, and nobody really cared. So I had compassion and I had empathy. And I think I heard my colleague here at SiriusXM say this, Zelina Maxwell, that that should be the default, to have compassion, to have empathy. So that's what I did. That's what so many other people did, because I think it's important to realize these things do happen. And if we don't have compassion, then people are just going to be ignored and they're going to feel isolated. And I also realized that with Jussie, he is a celebrity. So the folks that I knew when I was growing up, they didn't have that access to that kind of platform. So my initial reaction was compassion.
So what do you make now that we're at a very different point, which is to say that there are charges against Smollett for having, in the eyes of law enforcement, fabricated this. And the police chief didn't, you know, seem at all antipathetical to concerns about people being attacked on racial grounds or on grounds of sexual orientation, but said this would undermine the ability of law enforcement to get people to take this as seriously as it should be taken. I think you argue against that. Why is that the case?
That was just so outrageous when I heard the police chief say that. And I really have to push back against this idea that it'll be harder for victims of hate crimes to be believed. It already is hard for us to be believed. If you believe victims of hate crimes before Jussie, you will keep believing them. If you didn't believe victims of hate crimes before Jussie, and you won't believe them after, that has nothing to do with him. So the idea that the Chicago PD, and to be quite frank with you, it's just very rich for them to say that, considering that we have black children being shot and killed on their watch, and investigations that have not been as thorough and as swift as Jussie's was and is. So that's just not true. And as a black gay man, I could tell you we aren't believed. And so in order for him to say that, he would have to believe that there was some type of that there was all this faith in us before, and there isn't. I have had friends who've been beaten into the pavement. I've had friends who've been shot and killed. I've had friends who've been murdered. And it's so hard to charge a hate crime. So I just felt like that is not true. And if you are law enforcement, you should be emotionally intelligent enough and well-trained enough to be able to take a hate crime accusation seriously. And I lay out example after example way before Jussie of victims of hate crimes being ignored. So that's just it's just wrong. It's not true. And I was really offended by that.
And we'll make sure to have a link to your to Clay Kane's article from The Washington Post about this very topic on our website.
Go ahead. One more thing.
Please.
This is really important. David, why doesn't it happen the other way around? As I lay it on my Washington Post article, there is a long, tragic history of white people falsely accusing black people of crimes. Carolyn Bryant, Susan Smith, most recently Kristen Rimes in South Carolina. Why isn't the credibility of white people damaged? Why isn't it harder to believe white people? Why isn't it harder to take white people seriously? And the reason why it doesn't work the other way around is because the true reason why people don't believe black LGBT victims of hate crimes is because of white supremacy, misogyny, and homophobia. So let's call a thing a thing. If it doesn't work the other way around for white people, then let's call it what it really is. It's white supremacy. It's not because of one black gay person in history who may have allegedly falsified a police report. One, considering the long epic history, and we're talking about this during Black History Month. When you look at Carolyn Bryan, who is 85 years old, who accused Emmett Till of touching her or winking at her or something, and she is still living her life in Mississippi as her governor, Phil Bryant, her nephew, Phil Bryant, is the governor of Mississippi.
I think, I want to step in. My understanding, and some journalists and others have looked at this, is that there has been no link proven between the accuser of Emmett Till and the governor, even though there was some thought of some shared surnames there. But regardless of that, I think the larger point you're trying to make, though, is the question of a default, and the idea of a default being that white people will be believed, and the default people that being that you're saying people of color, African Americans, that gay people may not themselves be believed if they're saying that they have been targeted for attack, particularly by virtue of their identity.
Absolutely. It should work both ways, but it doesn't because of white supremacy, and that's an important point.
You know, in Chicago, one of the things I saw laid out by a journalist columnist for the Chicago Tribune was the record of the Chicago police, not only in the question of people being shot, but the question of homicides being resolved there, that is solved there, that charges being pressed against perpetrators of those homicides, particularly against African-Americans. I think the Washington Post did its own survey that going back to 2011, something like only 25% of homicides had charges brought against them, that is, they were solved by police, at least in their own judgment. How does this comport with the way in which you find law enforcement to deal with accusations or concerns about crimes against African Americans?
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, David, because when the Chicago police did their press conference, the way they were talking about Jussie Smollett, I almost thought that he confessed. I said, oh, gosh, because they were speaking in such absolutes. And I respect law enforcement. I respect police. But I will tell you that I have seen people who have shot unarmed black children on camera and get more of a presumption of innocence than Jussie Smollett is getting. And I just hope that people are able to give him the same grace that the person who shot Laquan McDonald 16 times in 14 seconds in Chicago. The
police
same
officer.
Grace to exactly Jason Van Dyke, who was found guilty, but it took four or five years to get to that. The same grace to the police officer who shot Tamir Rice in Ohio, who is still a police officer. So it's just fascinating to me that. You know, he didn't commit a violent crime if he did commit this crime.
And yet, in the very brief time we have before we go, can you understand why some people would say, you know, this guy is exploiting his prominence but also his identity to get attention, try to further his career? Isn't there something warped about that?
Absolutely. If it's true, though, David, if it's true, and I do think that we, you know, in the beginning, a lot of folks jumped on it and, automatically condemned this incident. And now I feel like we're going on the other side of it.
And we're going to have to stop right there. Clay Kane, host of SiriusXM's The Clay Kane Show, thank you for sharing your insight today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You can continue conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller, with help from Matt Hoist, Asil Kibi, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer, Karen Schiffman, me. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.